broadcasting from Melbourne, Victoria. You're listening to the Investor Exchange. Tune in each week and listen to the guys from United Global Capital discuss the topics that matter the most to your finances. Each episode will help you separate the noise from what really matters, giving you timely and actionable information you can use. We'll cover areas related to financial markets, property, politics, personal finance, and the economy. Now, here's your host, Stephanie Sumner.
And a very good morning to everyone in the studio and to our listeners. Happy Friday.
Yay.
Good morning.
Good morning.
What a big week it's been. Federal election has been announced and MAPS is over. And Collingwood's probably going to lose again.
Oh, hey, easy.
You were doing well.
Easy.
Louis, anything to say?
I've already said everything.
Be careful, Louis. Yeah. Actions speak louder than words, unfortunately.
I value my job. but I do know what happened on the field, and the on-field performance was spectacular. Okay, I'll just come out and say it. We won.
Yeah.
We kicked your pants.
And look,
sorry,
well,
Collingwood.
Well deserved. West Coast too. Won. I mean, it was a game that did have moments where it was close, but overall, West Coast again, unfortunately, deserved the win.
We did.
Four on the trot.
Four on the trot, yeah.
Against us, that is.
Yep. Yeah. You haven't beaten us in 2 years.
Mm. And the bizarre thing with that is West Coast hadn't beaten Collingwood at the MCG for something like 15 to 20 years until last year.
Mm-hmm.
And now they've done it three times in a row.
Yeah.
I just wish their timing had been different.
I wish they'd stayed at Subiaco and not figured out how to play on the big ground.
But they're going to win tonight, right, guys?
Of
Collingwood's going to make a comeback
because every single
week it's the same thing when you're a Collingwood supporter.
Yeah, that's right.
Yep,
all right.
We'll be there.
Well, we're going to kick off our first topic for today, and it's going to be talking to Joel about initial public offerings.
It's been a big couple of weeks with IPOs coming out in the United States.
Oh. Tell our lay listeners what an IPO is.
It's an initial public offering. It's the first time that shares are being offered to the public to invest in for a company that will first be listed on the stock exchange.
So it's a private company.
Private company. Yep.
That has been in existence for short period of time, long period of time.
Oh, yeah, actually, can I just clarify? Sometimes. Not necessarily private. It may have started private, but quite often you can be public and not listed on an exchange.
Ah, public unlisted.
Yes.
Yep.
So,
okay.
And more than likely they would be public prior to listing, made the conversion from private to public in preparation.
I see.
But yes. It's the first time they're able to market via a stock exchange.
Okay. So it's the first time your average investor has access to this share.
Correct. Yes. So so a number of big companies are coming to the market, not so much on the US, on the Australian Stock Exchange, but predominantly in the US stock market.
There's one I thought was coming soon, quite a big transport, well, kind of transport one. Is that one of them, Joel?
Correct.
Yep.
So we actually had its little baby cousin, Lyft, which IPO'd a couple of weeks ago. Lyft is the ride-sharing app, mainly in the United States, not here in Australia. I don't believe it is anyway.
Heard of it.
You'll see it on some movies. They seem to be doing some good product placement if you go and watch a couple of movies. But it IPO'd for a valuation of $24 billion. Now, this is one of the interesting things that I'm noticing. That most of these IPOs are technology-based companies. They have some form of, involvement in the internet and cloud computing or the Internet of Things. So we've got Lyft that's come on board, $24 billion market cap. It IPO'd at $72. But today it's now trading at $60.
You've
got to be careful with some of these IPOs because when they, not all of these are, dead set ringers and easy money makers. Now, one of the key pitfalls that I'm seeing right now is that a lot of these companies are not profitable. In fact, they are burning cash. That is something to be aware of. So Lyft, let's take Lyft for instance. Lyft IPO'd with losses of $688 million in 2017, growing to $911 million US dollars in 2018.
Wow. So that's losses.
It's
cash
losses.
That's been burnt.
Burnt. Gone
Four.
Through.
So, nearly $1 billion.
So the it's a $1.5 billion over the last 2 years. Now, Uber, we all know Uber,
yeah.
It is here in Australia.
Yes.
It's expected to list sometime this month with an IPO valuation or valuing the company at $100 billion. Now, Uber has lost $3 billion just in the last 12 months.
From what?
Just from operations. It's not just not a profitable company.
They're spending more than they're bringing. Yeah.
Wow. And it has lost a total combined value of $10 billion in profits in just the last 3 years.
So it's never turned a profit.
Never turned a profit.
In fact, it's
so close to turning a profit.
So how do they get such a big valuation?
Yeah.
Well, obviously the platform is massive. It's worldwide. The adoption is significant.
But who's going to buy it?
Well, there is an expectation that one day they'll be able to monetize that scale and that volume by, you know, eventually be able to raising prices or lowering costs.
But won't other competitors come into the market then, like your Lyft?
Well, Lyft and IPO and Uber are the main ones in the Western economies.
Yeah.
But then you think about companies like WeChat over in China,
huge,
which you know, doing their own sort of ride sharing or transportation solution. But then you've also got so the idea is that Uber is spending a lot to try and move into self-driving cars.
Yes.
And so the idea is that, and the big play, you have to be a big believer in this, is that Uber will eventually benefit from the fact that they won't have to split the revenue that they're generating with drivers.
Yes.
Oh, so own enough market share in terms of users.
Own enough market share, dominate the market, and then eventually your cost can come down because you can get rid of the drivers.
Yeah.
Because cars move to autonomous driving.
Right, so your margins go through the roof.
But I think autonomous driving still has some way to go before it's going to become mainstream. I
mean, and legal.
And legal. You know, you're probably still looking at a good 10 years before it really becomes something that even starts to be recognized, and probably 20 years before it becomes mainstream
and accepted.
And that's assuming that we don't have any, you know, high profile crashes that are caused by autonomous driving. I mean, we know that, you know, sometimes these types of events can be very damaging in the early stages to adoption of those new technologies.
I'd come in with a couple more points on that, because you're absolutely right. Autonomous driving would halve one of their major costs and make it hugely profitable, is the people side of it. But there's also a series of other cost benefits that could be achieved. Like if there is better fuel efficiency, either from the cars themselves or by mass conversion to electric power at a cheaper cost, that could save a 10% cost of the driver's costs, and that could be a big move to profitability.
The only thing I'd think of, though, with a driverless car is I'd want them to have tested it for quite a few years before I decide to get in and have it going myself.
It has to be legal.
Yeah. But once that's in, I don't know that I'd just sort of kind of watch and see.
Well, you'd probably get an option. Yeah. Right now you've got UberX and the regular Uber. You'll probably have an Uber D, Uber driverless, or something like that, which is an even lower cost. It'll just be another option for you.
Yeah.
But then the other thing will be the cost of the car itself. If the actual vehicle costs less for the driver to purchase or lease, then that would lower one of the inputs. And then if Uber can better monetize not just the ride itself, but the data, I think that's the big one, which is there to be monetized, is all this data about traffic and people's movements and things like that. That's really where they have a big advantage in the market because of their domination.
It's also probably one of their biggest risks, though, with that data and privacy around it. I think that was on the news this morning. They were discussing that.
They don't care.
Yeah, well, they'll have to care, because if something happened like a Facebook and what went down with that, they will have to actually care, and it will cost them more money.
True. Yeah, but how did Facebook actually go down? Yes, a big reputational problem, but they'll actually only change their privacy at the margins.
Yeah, but I'm sure there was a cleanup process and costs with legal.
Correct. That's right. I'm sure there's big costs that go into it, but maybe their privacy has gone from, say, from a base of 100, maybe their privacy has caused their revenue to come down to a 99 or 98.
Yeah.
It's really only at the margins. Mm-mm. Same thing will happen with Uber and any other data-driven tech company.
Yeah.
So, 100%. So, look, it's interesting just that we're noting that there's a lot of these new IPOs coming onto the market. Now, a couple others that might be of note or of interest. Company by the name of Pinterest. Does anyone know what Pinterest is?
Pinterest.
Oh. Was it a homeware sharing picture site? It's sort of along the lines of Instagram, but not quite.
I thought it was even before Instagram.
It was
too.
Before Instagram. Yeah.
It's pre-Instagram. It's a really easy way to save your browsing content from the internet and share it with others.
Yep.
And I think its ratio of female to male users is 10 to 1.
Mm. Right. Well, it too is coming to the market with an expected valuation of about $11 billion, but it too is hopeless at making money, although it's a little bit better than Lyft and Uber. It's only lost $130 million in 2017 and $63 million in 2018.
Okay.
So it doesn't seem so far away from profitability as perhaps some of the others.
What's their cap?
They're expected to come up with a valuation of $11 billion
right.
on a list.
Okay.
Now, there is another one that we are expecting to go public soon. You might have heard of this company, Airbnb.
Yes.
Now, we don't know exactly what it's going to come on and what the valuation might be, but it's expected that it could be anywhere up to $100 billion itself.
Yeah.
I haven't had a good look at the financials at this stage. And then there's one that seems to stand out amongst this group that seemed to be a little bit different to all of the four that I've just mentioned. A company called Zoom, a video conferencing business.
Okay.
So it's along the lines of Skype. We use Zoom here in the office to conduct some of our conferences with our business partners. And this company is very different because it actually makes money.
What?
Incredible, isn't it? You know, this. Zoom is expected to come onto the market. I actually don't know what the estimated valuation is, but it has made, what have we got here? In 2016, it made $61 million in revenue. Revenue grew to $152 in 2017 and then $331 in 2018, generating profits last year of $7.1 million, but free cash flow of $23 million.
How are they making their money?
It has no debt, has $176 million in cash on its balance sheet, growing revenues at almost 100% per annum or even a little bit more than that.
Ooh.
This is an interesting business.
But Joel, is that through advertising that they're making their money? How is the company making money?
Subscription-based model. Yeah. Love subscription-based businesses. Yeah. And I love it when there is this wide adoption where companies start to adopt it because of this network effect that happens.
It's kind of like an Apple.
Everyone's going to it because everyone's using it.
Yeah. So their customers are businesses.
Mm. Correct. That's right. As Australian investors, unfortunately, we can't get access to the five IPOs because as Australian retail investors, the US just doesn't let us actually get access to those investments. It's not allowed. However, we do have a strategy that we use here at UGC to actually play IPOs once the stock is actually on the market. And it's been used quite successfully in the past. So what we like to do is we like to see that the stock comes on, see how it trades, give it a week to 2 weeks, see how the price action settles down. Now, if the stock comes out of the gate and starts rallying straight away, what we like to see is that the stock then has a consolidation. Now, that consolidation is where the stock pauses, has a bit of a pullback, but that pullback is either shallow or it's sort of, you know, sideways. And then as soon as it starts to move back above that previous peak, we start buying it. No. But it has to meet all of our other fundamental criteria. So I'm not sure how Uber's going to go when it comes onto the market, but it's probably not a stock that we're going to get close to actually recommending for our clients. But you might want to take a look at Zoom and watch how its market action plays and its share price action plays out in the first few weeks and look for that pullback after the rally. And if you get it and then it starts to break out again, it might be a good time to get into it and buy it.
Mm.
Joel, why would it pull back? Why would it go up and then pull back?
Usually it's just a supply-demand thing. Sometimes a stock rallies too far, buying power dries up because people say it's rallied too far in the short term. Mm. You get a little bit of drift sideways, and then it starts to go again.
Is it also because a lot of investors go into the IPO just for the initial bounce?
Absolutely. Yeah. So you got to understand that most of these IPOs that are coming to the market, this is essentially a way for the early investors, the venture capitalists that supported these businesses and gave them seed funding to actually realize their investment. These companies, some of them have, like Uber, have been private for 10 years since they first started. Started off with little bits of seed capital, did multiple raisings through venture capital firms out of, you know, Silicon Valley. Now it's time those venture capital firms want to cash out, realize some valuation and realize some of their profits.
So there might be an investment company that will now be sitting on $2 million worth of shares, as an example, after the IPO happens. And then they think, well, okay, let's get some of our investment bank back.
Yep.
Let's let the share price float. And then after 1 or 2 weeks, after we get an initial bounce, we can maybe reduce our investment to half of what it was,
correct,
put some cash on our balance sheet, but still hold on to half our investment, something like that,
correct,
just to reduce their holdings.
Yep. Yeah. And a lot of the time, these venture capitalists will still maintain significant holdings after the IPO if they believe in the long-term story of the company.
Mm.
And a lot of them will get out and look for the next unicorn that might pop up.
And Joel, sometimes there are rules for people that are holding shares at the IPO that there's an escrow period that they can't sell within.
A lot of the time that relates to management.
Management only.
Yep. Yeah, okay. And key executives and a lot of the founding employees that started with the business, they'll usually have a lockup period, sometimes 1, 2, even 3 years.
Mm.
Just so that when the company does come to market, that the investors that are buying into the IPO know that the whole premise for, you know, listing and whatever is in the what they call the S, I think it's called the S1 in the US, or the prospectus is what we call it here in Australia. That there is some certainty that the key people behind that company are going to be around even after the company actually lists.
Good one. All right, certainly something that I didn't know much about, so thanks for all that information. We're now going to throw to a quick break and we'll be back after this message.
Want to learn the strategies that have achieved returns more than double the return of the average superannuation fund? Each day, clients of United Global Capital are using strategies and tactics that were once thought the domain of the professional investor or the super rich. Book your seat at UGC's Financial Fast Track Seminars, where you'll learn the science behind selecting high-performance stocks and real estate, how you can participate in advanced strategies like property development, short selling, and international investments, as well as how to protect your wealth against major adverse market events. To secure your seat, simply go to ugc.net.au/events and select the seminar that suits your needs. Seats are limited, so book your spot now.
Okay, and everyone, welcome back. We're going to throw to our second topic for today, and that is talking about self-managed superannuation and when it's worthwhile. Louis.
Thank you, Steph. I'm getting this question a fair bit at the moment. There's definitely interest out there for self-managed super funds, and people keep asking me, oh, should I have one or shouldn't I have one? When is it worthwhile? And also people coming to me because they have one or it's been suggested to them and they're really not sure, like, is it worthwhile? And for me, I come back to a couple of key points for when you should consider a self-managed super fund. Firstly, let me get to what a self-managed super fund actually is.
Yeah.
So for most people in Australia, I'd say pretty much everyone, you come out of school or university, you get your first job, superannuation is just the last thing on your mind. You get set up with a superannuation fund by your first employer, you still don't care about it, money starts going into the account, you still don't care about it, you're excited about your first paycheck. Over time and over your career, your superannuation balance grows, you might accumulate multiple super funds. Your super accounts sit with a retail superannuation fund or an industry super fund or a corporate plan, something like that, where the money is managed by a company on your behalf. They do the accounting, they receive the contributions into their bank accounts, and then they put that money into some investment that they've chosen on your behalf, and they've put in place some kind of insurance on your behalf. You've had nothing to do with the decision. It's all happened by default.
Yep.
So when you look at your superannuation and you start making choices, and we've talked about these things before, you've got some choices as to which other superannuation company could you move your money to and what other investments could you choose within each of those accounts. Now, a self-managed super fund is where you think, instead of transferring it to another company that has a superannuation trust, you're actually going to start your own trust. Like a family trust, you're going to...
It sounds complicated.
It does sound complicated, but it doesn't need to be complicated when you get someone to help you through the process. So you're starting a trust brand new, like a family trust, but it's a trust that meets superannuation rules. What it means is you're going to take money that's currently with your retail or whatever superannuation fund, and you're going to put that money into your self-managed super fund's bank account. That trust that you've opened, you'll open a bank account and you'll have actual cash in that bank account. Now that you've got access to the cash, you can then use that cash for whatever investment purpose you see fit.
So it gives you a lot more control, Louis. Is that what you're saying?
Absolutely. So when you're with a retail or industry super fund, you can only use the investments on their menu. Once you've got that money in a self-managed super fund and in cash, you are now considered a direct investor. Mm-hmm. You can open whatever investment account you want with whatever provider you want. You could open a share trading account. You could go to a direct managed fund. You could trade exchange-traded funds. You could find wholesale investments, or you could find different investments that are just not available any other way.
Art.
You could purchase an artwork. That's right. If it's going to be for investment purposes, you could buy a vintage car if it's going to be for investment purposes. And there's all kinds of rules and restrictions that you do need to meet, but it's all possible. You could buy a direct investment property.
Either residential or commercial.
Residential or commercial. So once you've got the cash in your super funds account, you can invest in anything you want. So when is that an advantage and when is that a disadvantage? Firstly, it's a disadvantage if you don't know what you're doing.
Most definitely.
Because worst case scenario, if you don't know what you're doing and you accidentally breach some of the superannuation rules, then the penalty is that your super fund will incur penalty tax, which is at the highest marginal tax rate, not just of the amount that you incorrectly invested, but the entire balance of the super fund.
Geez, that sounds scary.
I was just going to say, you know, what would be the benefit then if I can just get somebody else to do it and worry about it? And
okay, exactly. Yeah. So if you're coming to this for the first time, then you do want good information and you want good guidance.
Yeah.
So don't come into it lightly because it is a serious matter and you definitely don't want to get it wrong. Because if your superannuation represents most of your retirement savings, it would be awful for you to have that halved in the penalties that apply from getting it wrong. So first thing, it's only for people who are willing to take it seriously. It doesn't mean you need a lot of time, but you do need a little bit of time. It doesn't mean you need a lot of expertise, but you do need a little bit of knowledge to understand what you can and can't do. And I would suggest, unless you are an expert yourself, I would suggest getting a good amount of guidance and someone to help you through the process.
If I came to an advisor like UGC and said, can you set me up a self-managed super fund, are you guys liable for it or any errors if something goes wrong?
No.
No.
No, that's right.
So the responsibility sits with you when you are running your self-managed super fund.
Right.
You can appoint other people to be the accountants and the advisors.
Yeah.
But if you, if something goes wrong and a penalty comes to the super fund, then that responsibility sits with you as the trustee. You can't forward that on to someone else, which is actually how it works with your personal tax as well. If something goes wrong with your personal your accountant might have prepared it. Your accountant might have given all the advice. But if there's a bill that comes as a result, that bill sits with you.
Yeah.
You can't forward that to your accountant and say you got it wrong. Yeah. And the same thing applies with superannuation.
And with the self-managed super fund, I mean, it's certainly something that I didn't know about until sort of Joel has introduced me to that line of thinking. But why isn't that something that's sort of discussed earlier and sort of given that information over to younger people? Is it because it's so risky, or is it because it's just, you know, less known, or
what? Okay. I might have gone overboard in scaring you about the risks.
Yeah.
So it's just
more barriers to entry.
Right. Yeah.
Barriers to entry. That's right. So one thing is to just give it the respect it deserves, mm-hmm. but the number of people that are penalised for getting it wrong is absolutely minimal, is almost zero, unless people are being just stupid about it.
Or you've essentially, you know, got the intent of just doing something, you know, that is completely contrary to the law.
Yeah. But then again, why don't people know more about this? Why is it not discussed?
Okay. Now it comes down to, when is it right for me?
Yeah.
So if you're going to start a new trust from scratch, there's going to be costs involved.
Okay.
Whether it's a family trust or a superannuation trust, similar thing. When it comes to a self-managed super fund, there are costs for setting it up.
Yep.
And then there are costs for the yearly ongoing management. And I mean management in a way where you get other people to complete some of the required steps financial year.
Is it comparable to your current, just a retail super fund where they take the fees out and you kind of just don't know?
No, not quite. So with your retail funds, they have costs themselves.
Yep.
And when they have total accounts, maybe they've got $10 billion across their super funds, then they take all of their expenses with a retail fund plus their profit margin, and they say, all right, well, these are our expenses. We need to raise X dollars in revenue, which means every account has a certain percentage fee across it. And if your balance is low, well, then it's a relatively low fee. But if your account balance is high, well, then that fee becomes quite significant, and you're paying a lot for those administration or platform fees.
Right.
On a dollar basis.
With a self-managed super fund, doesn't matter if you've got $1,000 or $1 million, the requirements are the same. The requirements each year are for a tax return to be completed, financial statements, and an independent audit. And it doesn't matter how much is in the account. So when you engage people to complete those requirements, it's a flat cost.
Or it should be.
It should be a flat cost anyway. That's right. Thank you, Joel. Things to look out for. It's worthwhile, it can be worthwhile on a cost basis. Mm-hmm. So if you have a higher superannuation balance, and the general rule of thumb is 200,000, maybe 250,000, if your balance is more than that, then a self-managed super fund could be a less expensive option just on a cost basis. Unfortunately, that's what most of the content that you will find on the internet and even the tax office's website is geared towards. Looking at self-managed super fund as a cost minimization for people.
Right.
So it's not just all about cost?
It's not just all about cost. Thank you, Joel. It is one reason to have a self-managed super fund, but when you look at the content, then all the content you'll find online is geared towards people with account balances of more than 200,000.
Okay.
But self-managed super funds can invest in things that you can't otherwise invest in through a retail or industry super fund. So if you can find an investment that's going to perform a lot better and you can only get to that investment because you have a self-managed super fund, well, that's where it becomes worthwhile. Mm-hmm. I don't care if fees are high, if returns are going to be high.
Yeah, what's my net effect?
Exactly.
It's all about the value that's being added.
That's right, exactly. So with a self-managed super fund, you might be able to get an investment that has high returns or lower risks, or both, or has some aspect that you really like about it. Something which is more than just the fees of option A versus the fees of option B, which a lot of the information out there is geared towards.
Yep.
So if you find an investment option that that makes it worthwhile to have slightly higher fees on your account, well, then it's worth considering self-managed super funds for lower balances. We often consider self-managed super funds for people with less than 200,000 to invest, because there can be options that they can do that, especially what Joel talks about. And when it becomes more complicated, like with portfolio hedging or options trading or things like that, really good money-making schemes that you just can't do with a retail fund.
Correct. Yep. Absolutely right, Louis. I couldn't have said it better myself. It's all about the value that could be added by getting access to a wider range of investment opportunities and strategies that you wouldn't get through your typical super fund. And if the value that can be added significantly outweighs the increase in the costs and your net difference between where you are versus what you can get inside a self-managed super fund makes sense, then it makes sense to set up self-managed superannuation funds on lower balances.
So absolutely. To put some figures on that, so if I were to move from a retail or an industry fund that maybe the fees, if I looked at an annual statement, were $500, I might be up for maybe $2,000 or $3,000 a year by going to self-managed. But if I'm generating $10,000 or $15,000 more in return, well, I'm still $10,000 to $12,000 better off.
Absolutely.
Yep. You're exactly right.
That's the formula or the calculation I need to make.
Yep. Absolutely. Exactly. Yeah. I mean, we have an annual fee of around $2,000 is our cost for managing a self-managed super fund. Mm-hmm. And if you can generate more than $2,000 a year, which you really should be able to do on a reasonable balance, well, then it's worthwhile.
Yeah.
If your balance is $200,000, then we're trying to generate... Well, okay, if your balance is currently $200,000, mm-hmm. and your current costs are, say, $1,000 with your current super fund, then your extra fee per year is $1,000. Mm-hmm. If you can't generate an extra $1,000 in returns on a $200,000 balance, then just stick with the retail or industry fund.
Right. And Louis,
but it's not hard.
Whilst the accountability stays with the owner of the fund as the trustee, you can still outsource a lot of the administration and the doing of the accounting. So you really don't have a lot of extra work to do if you do go down that path.
Correct.
By engaging qualified and good people.
That's right. Look, with our service that we have at UGC, we complete the... You engage us and we make sure the tax returns are done.
Yep.
You'll see them and you'll sign them at the end of the financial year, but we have them completed on your behalf. The same with the financial statements. We complete them, you see them, and then you sign off on them. But it's not an onerous job for you. That the onerous job and the time and the effort sits with us. You just need to oversee it and look at the statements that come out of it, and then you sign off on them. Same with the independent audit. We arrange it on your behalf, and again, you see it and you sign off on it. So there is attention required, there is responsibility required, but the time and effort requirement is much more minimal than people will think.
And just on that, with regards to who you're going to select with your administrator or your the person supporting you along the way, or the organization supporting you along the way, there are different levels of service standard as well. So I know of superannuation fund administrators that are doing super fund administration, what they call administration, for $650, $700 a year. But what does that entail? Well, you yourself have to keep all the records. You yourself have to be the mail house. You yourself have to liaise with the ATO and ASIC in regards to any details that need to be updated, addresses that need to be changed, payment of any bills, those types of things. And then at the end of the year, you've got to give that file over to those administrators so they can prepare the tax returns on your behalf. You don't get to see any regular consolidated reports throughout the course of the year. Unless you can generate them yourself. Mm. So you might know what's going on in one account and in another account, but you'll never ever get a full sense of what's actually going on unless you manually compute those and calculate them together. Or you could go to somewhere like ourselves, where we have the technology where the data feeds come into our operating system and into our administration system on a daily basis, and you've got all that transparency and that reporting. Yes, you pay a premium for it, but not much relevant. More of a premium.
Yeah. I'm not sure it is a premium, Joel.
I think it's fair value.
Well, I wouldn't even say that, because if you compare it to a $700 a year service, well, then there's too much time and effort involved. Well, not too much. There is that much more time and effort involved that you have to do. If most of the time you're looking at around $2,000.
Yeah.
But when you're looking at a service provider, look at what technology they have. Because if they don't have a lot of technology behind them in the way that they're managing it, then they're going to be doing everything manually and you're not going to get a lot of visibility from it. There's still a lot of old school accountants, yes, that are very paper-based. Mm. If you're paying $2,000 a year for one of those, you won't get much. But if you have someone who has a lot of technology behind it, then you know you're going to get a lot of automation and low-effort tasks at the end of that.
And I think it's important that people realise the platform that UGC have invested in is really efficient for not only delivering those reports, but it also helps people be able to look at their portfolio.
Yeah, super efficient.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Okay. Certainly good advice and something that we can all sort of think about and mull over, and just making sure that you've got the right person doing that kind of a job for you. So thanks for that advice, guys. We're now going to throw to another quick break and we'll be back after this message.
Are you concerned about your finances? Maybe you're not sure if you'll have enough money to retire on. Or maybe you've received a redundancy, inheritance, or even a significant promotion, or perhaps a life-changing medical diagnosis. Regardless of your concern or financial position, United Global Capital's advisors are experts in the areas of strategic financial planning, taxation, superannuation and self-managed superannuation funds, risk management, estate planning, and investments. Don't let fate dictate your financial future. Take control today and contact United Global Capital for a no-cost, no-obligation financial strategy consultation. Simply call 03 8657 7640 or email info@ugc.net.au and book your appointment today.
Okay, welcome back, guys. And we're now going to throw over to Brett. Brett's going to talk today about market sentiment and the trends in residential dwelling types.
Okay, thanks, Steph. Interestingly enough, a lot of the different researchers and ratings agencies are still forecasting further downturns in residential property values. And that's fine. We've sort of been talking about that in previous episodes. But the part that's conflicting with that, well, maybe not conflicting, but the sentiment around that is that Australians are suddenly a lot more optimistic about where the housing market is heading. So even though the forecasts are that the, you know, the median dwelling prices or values are likely to continue to drop for a period of time, Australians are more optimistic now than they have been for quite some time about entering the market or buying a property. Now, this came from Westpac do their what's called the latest Westpac MI Consumer Sentiment Index. So this is their one for April. And the sentiment around housing improved in April. So they have what they call the time to buy a dwelling index, which rose 2.4% to a figure of 119.4. So what does that mean? Well, that's a four-year high to begin with.
Well, really?
Okay. Yeah. So Australians are more a four-year high of that particular index.
Jeez.
Yeah, which is bizarre, really, when you think of what's been happening over the last 4 years.
Yeah.
And it's 33% higher from its low, which was in mid-2017. But apparently its long-term average is around that 120. So we're sort of at 119.4. We're close to that long-term average. Now, what a reading means, though, is a reading of 100 indicates that the number of optimists and pessimists are in balance, roughly the same. So a reading over 100, which was seen here at 119, indicates that Australians now believe it's a good time to buy a home.
Okay.
So the sentiment is that the market's improving.
And we would concur, I would say.
Yeah. And look, there's a number of other factors that are probably contributing to this sentiment. Of course, improving affordability as values have come down and obviously interest rates have remained low. There's more and more Australians seeing that housing's becoming more affordable now than it was a year or 2 years ago. And of course, other indicators in the property market, such as clearance rates and building approvals and access to finance with interest rates is all, you know, good for the person looking to buy.
Brett, I'm going to go out on a limb here. I reckon the worst of it is done, personally.
Big call.
Yeah, big call.
I'm not saying that the prices won't still come off a little bit, but I think that I'm already starting to see things improve. I have just had two clients last month refinance loans. One client got a 10-year interest-only loan, refinanced investment loan for 4.18%. Another client got a 5-year interest-only loan, refinanced for 4.09% for an investment loan. Those loans were unthinkable this time last year in the middle of last year. And in fact, I don't think those loans were even thinkable in 2016 and 17.
No, I don't think so.
So I'm starting to see already, and I've already had some chats with some of the mortgage brokers that we do business with, and they themselves are saying that the silly stuff is over.
Yeah.
That the banks and credit are now starting to be more realistic with their assessment of borrowing. And you've had a number of banks come out and say in the last few weeks, we are open for business. We admit that we probably went too far last year. We want to lend. Come and do business with us.
And look, the part of it, I agree with the majority of what you're saying, like whether we're through the worst of it, it's a hard thing to really pick, like when's the real bottom. Like there'll be a point in time in hindsight we'll be able to say, well, that was the bottom. Now, we're not going to know when that is until the data comes through over time. But I believe we're probably close to the bottom, or we may still see some further declines, but we're certainly not going to see, you know, we've always said we're never going to see it drop off a cliff. And I don't believe that we're going to see any drastic declines, and I believe that market activity is going to continue to improve. Now, I want to talk about something that Louis likes to get onto as well, is that psychology and sentiment are, I believe, a good early indicator as well, because before someone takes action, they usually have a process that they go through in their own head to come to a decision.
Yep.
And this sentiment indicator is an early indicator that they're starting to think about it more and more, so therefore the activity of buying is likely to happen as a flow-on effect.
I think there's definitely a big enough section of buyers and also a big enough section of sellers that have been deferring their plans for maybe 1, 2, or even 3 years. There's been people who want to buy homes but have been prevented by either skyrocketing prices or access to finance. And then there's been sellers in the last year to 18 months who haven't wanted to sell because in their mind it's a depressed market and they don't want to do that for whatever reason. So I think we are now going to enter a consolidation period.
That's a good way to describe it.
So, yeah. Joel, I'll support your call. I wouldn't be surprised at all if this is it.
Yep.
But I also wouldn't be surprised if these forecasts of a little bit more of a downturn are correct as well. But I think either way, we're going into a consolidation where we had this period of time where a lot of buyers and sellers just froze.
Yep.
And we're now seeing that to loosen up a bit more. I think what we'll see is more transaction volumes.
That's the part that I think is coming. Yep. And I'm going to make a prediction on that side of things, is that we've gone through the Royal Commission now, the flow-on effect, the knock-on effect of that starting to flow through. The price drops have been evident for a year or so now, so that's starting to bottom out and balance out. Everyone's aware of it. The last part of it, I think, that's going to influence people sitting on their hands and getting them into activity is going to be the election. Once that election phase is over, once we know who the government is, maybe a month or so after that election and things are consolidated again, that's when I believe that the transaction volumes will really start to lift again.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that'll be roughly mid-year, which is a good time typically for people to be buying and selling.
Mm-hmm.
So that's my prediction, is we'll see the transaction volumes increase from mid-year on.
There you go.
Yeah.
All right.
Exciting times.
Now, Steph also mentioned in her little intro to me that I was going to talk about a trend in dwellings or dwelling types. I wanted to just highlight something that that came to my attention. Not that we weren't aware of it, but it was highlighted last week when we had one of the country's leading valuation and advisory firms highlight a trend they've seen. And we've had the long-term belief with investment property and residential that land appreciates, dwellings depreciate. So therefore, the more land content you can buy, the better quality of the asset, and the more likely you're going to generate capital growth over the long term.
Mm-hmm.
The part that's starting to really influence this scenario a bit lately is that there's more and more medium density dwellings being built now than ever before. So by medium density, you think you've got houses, you've got apartments, but in the middle there are these townhouses where you still get your own little plot of land, but you know it may be a two-story or even sometimes a three-story dwelling that still gives you all the living space internally, but you don't have as much land. You'll still get a little yard and something at the front.
Yep.
And we used to see that these were really infill sites that you'd see in the middle ring suburbs, so in the inner 5 to maybe 10 kilometres. And apartments were never seen sort of 20 to 30 kilometres from the city because everyone could afford houses on blocks of land. Well, lately, there's a lot more people now that are looking at houses maybe 20 to 30 kilometres out of the city where it's affordable, but the houses are old. They might be on 600 square metres of land, which we typically like for investment purposes, but they're now weighing it up going, well, that house is a bit run down. It's going to take a fair bit of work. Whereas this townhouse here that's the same price may only be on half that amount of land, but I can move into it straight away. It's new, it feels good, and I'm going to enjoy living there instantly, and I've got the same internal living space.
Mm.
So we're seeing a trend where more and more people are happy to buy the townhouse over the house these days, purely because of the newness of it and the better quality of the actual building and dwelling inside.
And a lot of them are in areas that are actually more convenient to cafes, restaurants, shops, these types of things, than a traditional house where you've got to get in the car to drive down.
That's right.
Can I ask, though, with them being built and they're all nice and shiny and new, will they last as, you know, I mean, are we actually getting the builds done as well as what they were in the past?
That's a bit of a subjective thing. I mean, I guess you don't know until time sort of starts to have an impact on that. But I guess if you know the quality of the builder, if you've got a building inspection or there's a way for you to look at the materials and the way it's built, yeah, that's a really hard question to answer. But typically for a building to get a certificate of occupancy, it must meet certain standards. And there has to be certain quality. And I guess when you do, if you're buying a townhouse that already exists, you'll have a chance to walk through it and get a pest and building inspection done. If you're buying off the plan, well, I guess you've got to look at the quality of the builder and the inclusions and materials they're building it out of to try and make some assessment.
You'd think ahead, especially if it's somewhere for you to live. So if you're just talking about what price am I going to buy a 30-year-old house versus a relatively new townhouse, what am I going to pay for it today? And then what might I sell it for in 20 or 30 years' time if it's a house to live in? And if you buy the older house today, well, by the time you're selling it, then it's maybe a 60, 70, 80-year-old house, and your buyer at that time isn't thinking it needs a reno. They might be thinking it just needs to be knocked down completely.
Right. Yeah.
Whereas you buy your newer townhouse in 20, 30 years, that only needs a reno. So your option A versus option B.
But what about the land banking aspect of having a larger property?
Yes, that's there, but you're still talking about a bigger land, but with a house that needs a full demolition and rebuild.
Yeah.
So that's a barrier compared to a 30-year townhouse that maybe just needs a renovation and a facelift. Yeah. That's right. So you're still getting a similar consideration at that time. Which one appreciates more will purely depend on what's popular at the time.
And its location as well.
All those
other
things.
As Joel said before, quite often these new townhouses that people are liking and leaning towards, not only is it because it's newer, quite often they're because of the way councils like to have more dwellings closer to their central activity areas of the suburbs, quite often they're closer to the trains and the shops as well. So, yeah, we still believe, you know, land is still the most valuable asset you can buy in property, but there's a shift towards townhouses where we think that, you know, there's going to be some price growth in townhouses, maybe in a parallel with house and land.
Good one.
There you go.
All right. Well, to wrap up, guys, we're going to throw to our favourite segment of the day, and that is You Can't Be Serious. And I think all of you have actually got a You Can't Be Serious this morning. Who wants to start?
Well done, team.
Joel?
Well, look, you know, we are the state of protest and outrage.
Oh, we have been this week.
We've had the ACTU unions running down and running amok,
Burke Street,
protesting in Burke Street. Yeah. But the protests that caught my eye this week were the good old vegans.
What's their beef?
And look, you know, I'm all for people that, you know, have their own ideas about, you know, the way to live their own life. I guess sometimes I just get frustrated when people think that they're high and mighty and righteous enough that they can tell me how to live my life.
Anyway, that's your wife's job.
That's exactly right. I've already got one of those. So I started getting, you know, a little bit sort of interested in, you know, how we might be able to take a bit of fun at the old vegans. And so I typed into Google a couple of old, funniest memes of for vegans. And I came across a couple of rippers. So there is this one meme that I've come across, and it's basically saying, if you're trying to save the animals, why are you eating their food? The next one, which I quite like, is my food shits on your food.
Yes.
And the next one, you've gone vegan. So why can't you just be like normal people and kill animals, the planet, and yourselves?
Yeah. Oh, gosh. I hope we've got no vegan listeners.
Oh, there must be one.
I'm sure we do. Please email your complaints to
Joel.
J.Hewish at ugc.net.au.
To trashbin at ugc.
Louis.
There's a terrifying story of a lady who came home to find strange movements in her house. She suspected a burglar was in the house and locked themselves in the bathroom.
Right.
The bathroom door was shut. Mm. They could hear the rustling inside there and even see shadows of movement underneath the door. Called the police. Police come to the bathroom door. They knock. and they say, we're coming in, and they come in to find a robot vacuum cleaner.
Love it.
They're taking over.
Now, the king of You Can't Be Serious.
Oh, look, I don't think I can compete with Joel today. Now, this does have maybe a bit of a vegan connection to it, but Trade Me is the New Zealand version of eBay, in effect. It's massive over there. They use it more than eBay. They had a listing recently that's got a lot of attention. A Kiwi farmer has listed his sheep on Trade Me, mm-hmm. and he's listed it as a ride-on lawnmower. Taking a photo with a seat, like a saddle on its back. So some of the puns have all been coming out, you know, things like, I would assume this is a one sheep power four-wheel drive model. One person asked, have you had many inquiries about this lawnmower? It says, does it work good in tight spaces if I need to make a U-turn? The part I found funny, though, is he had a starting bid. Now, I don't know how much a sheep's worth if you're going to, you know, use it for meat for the vegans out there or just for its wool. But it was started at $12,000. It's currently got a bid of $21,300.
Wow.
One for the vegans to go and save, hey?
Absolutely. Yeah. Now, Joel, bring us home. One more.
Okay, I've got the last one. So we all know Lionel Messi.
Oh, yes. God.
It's pretty amazing, isn't he? He's pretty good with the ball at his feet. Well, just this week, Pope Francis has warned fans that they shouldn't be too quick to call Messi God. So Messi, if you don't know, Messi wears number 10. And so what the Spanish fans have said is they've called him Dios, which is D-I-O-S or right. D-10-S.
Right.
Okay. And Pope Francis has come out and said, look, the use of or calling Messi God or Dios is sacrilege.
Look, thanks everyone for your input today. And next week is Easter, so I'm not sure if we're going to actually have a session for the podcast. But anyway, if
we'll
don't,
work something out.
It's a bit decided.
Have a fabulous Easter, and we'll speak to all of our listeners again in the coming weeks.
Go Pies.
Bye, everyone.
Bye.
You've been listening to this week's episode of The Investor Exchange. To access this episode's show notes, go to theinvestorexchange.com.au. And follow us on Facebook at The Investor Exchange for updates on our latest episodes. This show is for entertainment and educational purposes only. Before making any investment decision, contact United Global Capital by emailing ugc.net.au for a personalized, no-cost, no-obligation financial strategy consultation. Or alternatively, email us at info@ugc.net.au.